All right, we are at Mix09 with Miguel de Casa.
Hi, Dan. How's it going?
Good. So for people that may not know you, who are you and what do you do?
I'm Miguel de Casa. I work for Novell, and I run both the Mono project, which is an open source .NET implementation. So we bring .NET apps to Linux and macOS, and I also run the Moonlight project. And that's just Linux specific. So just making sure that we can run Silverlight apps on Linux, and that's what I do.
Cool. So we just saw the Scott Guthrie keynote. So
yeah,
showed off some Silverlight 3, some new tool stuff. What's kind of your first impressions, and what's percolating in your mind after seeing some of the things that are coming down the road?
Well, there's a couple of them. One is I wish we had tools like that on Linux. That's the first one. No, but the second one is where. You know, the Silverlight 3 stuff is really exciting. The piece about finally having offline support for Silverlight, so being able to take a Silverlight application and running it as your desktop app, we've been asking for that for years because I think that Silverlight has a lot of future, and I would like that feature to include the desktop as well.
Sure.
So that's really exciting, kind of competing against Air. You know, people were starting to use Air. I think that this is the right thing to do. It's probably going to be very easy to bring to Linux because we already had kind of a out-of-browser experience ourselves, so we're going to have to readjust that to work in the same way as Silverlight 3 works. So that is really exciting. All the accelerated features are also really exciting. That is really interesting. And the other piece, which I think is fascinating, in particular for the Linux crowd, which, you know, they like to endorse the open codecs like Theorav, Vorbis, Ogg, and the Rack. And what is really interesting about Silverlight 3 is that instead of Microsoft being the only provider and the only decision maker for which codecs they bundle with the system, what Silverlight 3 supports is this mechanism by which you third parties can plug their own codec systems.
Mm-hmm.
So if the open source community feels strongly about Ogg and Vorbis and Theora. They can use those codecs with their video streaming, right? So, for example, if Wikipedia wanted to use that for their streaming, they could just plug it into the Silverlight player. We know that people feel strongly about that, and that's probably one of the best news that came out of this thing.
Sure.
That, plug your own destiny when it comes to codecs. Don't like the proprietary ones, plug, the rack from the BBC or plug Theorem Vorbis. So those are really exciting. All of the new controls, of course, we're excited because they're open source, so we don't have to move a finger for that. So we get all of that for free, and the applications that they're starting to show are really exciting. And finally, actually, some of the people in my team back home were watching the keynote using Moonlight on Linux.
Awesome.
Live. So, it works.
And it just worked, right?
Worked, yes.
Okay, excellent. So we're talking about codecs.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about that. Because you guys, originally when you were doing Moonlight, I think you started looking at some other implementations like FFmpeg to see how they were doing. Like, how did that all go and what's sort of the Moonlight implementation now? And is that something like, say, a .NET developer, let's just say you wanted to create your own reusable library for, say, encoding video. Is that something that's either reusable in the sources? What are some of the challenges, and what are you all looking for to, say, implement new codecs, for example?
So, in fact, that was probably, it's not a technical challenge. It was more of a legal challenge, getting the codecs to work with Moonlight. What happens is that there's an organization that licensed the patents for doing media decoding for a lot of these things. It's called MPEG-LA. And for MP3, I think it's Fraunhofer. It's a German-based company.
Yes, yeah.
So what happened basically is that the license terms basically, they have, you have to pay per unit, and then there's some caps and the usage.
Yeah.
And it's complicated. And what happened was that FFmpeg did have the capabilities, but it was licensed under the LGPL license.
Mm-hmm.
And what that meant is that if we in Novell were to negotiate with MPEG-LA a license for this code, we would have, if we use the FFmpeg code, we would be forced to distribute the same rights to everybody because that's how the LGPL works.
Right.
So basically, we needed to acquire an infinite license for everybody to use it. And, we're not in a position to fund infinite licenses for this. And it's just, it's a reality of how the market works today regarding the video patents. So, you know, when we had this collaboration with Microsoft over bringing Silverlight to Linux, this was kind of one of the areas where we needed help. Mm-hmm. So we worked with, you know, with Brian Goldfarb and the Microsoft lawyers and Scott Guthrie's team. And we figured a way in which we could make this both, you know, fully licensed from MPEG-LA and also bring this to Linux. And what happened is basically we're using, we're actually not distributing FFmpeg. You know, if you want on your own at home, you know, in the comfort of your basement, yes, you can build your own Moonlight with FFmpeg if you want a full open source stack. But for now, what we're doing is Microsoft is actually delivering the codecs to us.
Okay.
Right? So we work with Microsoft to port the codecs that Microsoft is using, that Microsoft is licensing. And so actually Microsoft carries the burden of dealing with MPEG-LA, right, mm-hmm, and those organizations. So all we do is you know, when you install Moonlight on your system and you try to play some video or get some audio, it pops up a dialogue that says, hey, you need the codecs, you want to fetch them. And it goes to the Microsoft server and fetches the codecs and installs them.
Okay.
So that's it. So it wasn't really a technical issue. It was more a legal issue.
Got it.
And, you know, this new feature in Silverlight 3 that allows people to use whatever codec they want is going to open the doors for the patent-free codecs. So.
And are you looking to do those, like, as, say, Novell, or are you all looking for either, like, a, or, say, working with the team for, like, sort of a sample or reference implementation of, you know, this is this particular format,
yeah,
for example, for other people to sort of implement and sort of standardize building these, yeah, codecs, or?
Well, for now, I think the focus of my team really is we want to ship Silverlight 2.0 as fast as possible. So we'll probably not spend a lot of time doing the codecs ourselves. But now that the APIs are public, now that Silverlight 3 is public, now that all this information is public, we'll be happy to either assist people that want to build this themselves. Mm-hmm. But I don't think we're going to spend a lot of time doing the codecs. In fact, there's an open source implementation today of Vorbis or Theora, I can remember. One of those that we built in C# about 5 years ago.
Oh, really? Okay.
For other things. We just built, it was called, it's all Vorbis. We built it for a little player called Platano at the time, which stands for banana.
Yeah,
which,
yeah.
You know, Prime. The whole monkey theme.
Yeah.
So we do have some sample code that already does decoding of Aug. So if somebody wanted to use that, they could start with that code base today. And we'll certainly help them. But our focus right now is let's ship Silverlight 2. And add some of the Silverlight 3 features so that you know, so that Moonlight is no longer lagging so much behind Silverlight 3.
Yeah, so let's actually talk about that real, yeah, quick. So in terms of where Moonlight is today and, mm-hmm, Silverlight 2 features, because I think, and in terms of Silverlight 3, are there things that you guys are not looking to, say, implement just because it becomes too large a footprint, and in particular things like when you're talking about, say, Mono, where there just is too much of the .NET framework to implement, and you guys are sort of cherry-picking what are the big things that developers want to do?
So in the case of Silverlight, our commitment is to do the 100% of Silverlight. So
okay.
We benefit a lot from the Mono code base because, you know, all the XML stuff, all the system stuff, you know, web services, that has been implemented already as part of Mono. Mm-hmm. So what we have to actually build is, you know, the graphics engine and the security system because Mono never had a security system.
Oh, you know, guys didn't do code access security?
No, we didn't do code access security. Mono, okay, never had code access security for assorted reasons. But we never implemented it. It was too much work, and we figured, you know, if you feed garbage in, you'll get the garbage out. So there was no verifier. So, you know, Mono will run your code as long as it was correct code, but if it was broken code, you know, you get what you provided.
Interesting.
With Silverlight, the story changes because you're going to be running code that comes from a possibly untrusted source in the network.
Yes.
So in that case, so we need to have a fully working verifier. We need to have both a metadata verifier and an IL verifier. We need to make sure that all of the, you know, open entry points to the APIs are secured, right? And that there's no way for an attacker to create, you know, a rogue Silverlight app and, you know, escape the sandbox.
Sure.
So in fact, the only reason we didn't do a preview of Moonlight 2.0 for Mix was we didn't feel comfortable unleashing to the world something that didn't have the full sandbox audited.
Got it.
So the sandbox is there. We just have not audited yet.
Okay.
So you know, give us a couple more months to go through our full audit and we'll release it to the world. But, you know, it was playing, people that were courageous enough were playing this thing. They were using the, you know, this, you know, Deep Zoom works, you know, all of that, a bunch of the demos work. So there's still some bugs left,
sure,
but security was really our concern for this release.
Interesting. Now, kind of switching gears in terms of some of the stuff when you started talking about the app verifier, one of the things I found really interesting that you had talked about on your blog was how you guys are instead of, say, using a CLR, doing native code execution.
Yes.
So maybe talk about some of that stuff for Mono, and in particular, what that enables you to do for building iPhone applications.
Sure, yeah.
Because that is very exciting, I think, to a C# developer.
It is. So what happens is that, you know, .NET historically has been jitted. So you take these .NET IL instructions, and on the fly you jit them to the target platform. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that if you have a modern CPU, you can actually translate that into more efficient code, or you can adjust it depending on the target architecture what you generate.
Sure.
It has that benefit, and you can also generate code dynamically. You know, it has a lot of real interesting features. And also the same binary will run on x86, x86-64, ARM, a variety of operating systems.
Right.
So that is really interesting. But it turns out that some architectures, well, not architecture, but some platforms, and by that I mean some combination of the CPU and the operating system, have decided that it's not a good idea to let users execute code dynamically. Usually the reason is a security concern. Right, so gaming consoles, for example, have the same limitation.
Sure.
And it has to do a little bit with the ecosystem. A PC, an XP system, you can have different levels of patches and features installed, so it's a little bit more diverse. While Xbox consoles or PS3 systems or Wii's are, they're identical for about 12 years. So if somebody were to break into the systems, they could create a large army of bots that would be very difficult to fix.
Interesting. Okay.
So that is the reason why typically these devices are locked down to prevent just-in-time compilation. You don't want, a stack exploit to basically open the doors for somebody to exploit these machines and create an army of these things.
But like for Xbox, why wouldn't? Because they are doing this right now with say XNA, where they are just running a CLR, and they have all the benefits of say an app verifier.
Yeah.
And a sandbox too, because you can't use network code, and I can't do a denial of service.
So in the case of XNA and the Xbox, there's a little bit of a secret handshake between Compact Framework XNA and the Xbox kernel. Mm-hmm. So they let them run this jitted code in XNA, but regular applications can't. So we're actually faced with that problem right now. So one of the things that we did for Mono was basically, instead of doing just-in-time compilation, we added a new feature where you can do a full static compile. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of taking NGen, what not the developers call NGen, and taking it to its full conclusion. So instead of just being a cache that accelerates just-in-time compilation, it actually does what a typical C++ compiler would do, and it generates a static version of it.
So, and by that I mean, like, you are literally taking, let's say we were using, system DLL, and you're burning it into the XE. If you will. Is that correct?
Yes.
And are you guys doing anything for just optimizing that, so you're only taking things that you're going to call?
Yeah. Well, we have a linker, right? So,
okay.
So we do the regular process where you link stuff that you don't use, that you don't actually put in there.
Right,
so,
okay.
So there is that piece. There is certainly that piece. And kind of the big difference really is that the code that you generate is native code. There's no JIT involved. In fact, when you run Mono on the iPhone, they strip the JIT engine, mm-hmm. right? Because there's... even if you have the JIT engine, it would be completely worthless. The moment that you JIT code, it can JIT the code. It's just when you try to execute it, the kernel will kill the application.
Sure, sure.
So, we save a couple, 100 kilobytes by removing the JIT engine. So there's no JIT engine.
Sure.
What that means, of course, is there's no reflection emit, and any kind of framework that likes to generate code dynamically and execute it, won't run.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. ASP.NET certainly does that a lot internally.
Well...
ASP.NET does it. Scenarios.
It's possible, yeah. In our implementation, we don't. So maybe ASP.NET from Microsoft has optimizations that we don't have.
Okay.
But if you take, for example, an ASP.NET app and you pre-compile it, you could theoretically running on the iPhone. I don't know that you want to, but you could if you wanted to. But for example, system regular expressions does that.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So when you generate regular expressions, you have this option to compile the regex.
Yeah.
And if you do that, that will not run on the iPhone.
Oh,
right?
Interesting. Okay.
Because it requires this feature to be available. So this same technology is what we're using to bring Mono to the Xbox and the PS3, because mm-hmm. both platforms prevent jitting from happening.
So let's actually talk about how... All right, I want to build my first, hello world iPhone application.
Sure.
And these don't have to be jailbroken iPhones.
That's right. Don't have to be jailbroken applications.
So how does it work? I know you guys have done some tool work in, say, Sharp Develop. Is there tools that do the, or is this command line, or just walk through kind of step by step?
Yeah. So I mean, from the perspective of what AP, so the issue is not really the complication. Let me take a step back. So we can certainly bring Mono to the iPhone, and it runs on the iPhone. The question is, which APIs are you going to use to build the apps, mm-hmm. right? So there's a couple of, obviously, you want to use the native APIs. We haven't spent the time doing a binding to the Cocoa APIs, so you can use them from C#. So that's a problem. That's the first problem. The second one is, we haven't ported Windows Forms or GTK# to that. It would look very ugly, so we haven't done it.
Okay.
So really what you're left with is the Mono VM and, you know, system XML. And with that, you can't really build a UI, right? So Mono for the iPhone is not as attractive as people think it is.
Okay.
Now, there is in particular one company called Unity Technologies, I believe.
Yeah, they were doing the graphics library.
Yeah, so what Unity does, they specialize in gaming, mm-hmm. right? So they have an IDE that builds games, and it happens that what powers the scripting is Mono. Mm. Right, so Unity Technologies, you build your game and you say, well, generate code for Windows or the Mac or the Wii or the iPhone. Mm-hmm. And those guys basically provide their own API. So you don't have, you know, System Windows Forms or WPF or any of that.
Sure.
You basically use their APIs and they talk about game objects and acceleration and gravity. And so you really build applications that take advantage of their, you know, universe.
And it's their game engine you're writing to.
Correct. So you basically.
But are you writing in C#?
Yeah, you can run it. Yes, okay. Yes. You can use three languages. They support three languages. One is C#, of course. Another one is Boo, which is like a Python language.
Yeah, I know.
It's very cute, and it has like a macro processing facility. A really interesting language. And the other one is called UnityScript. UnityScript is, think of JavaScript, where you take out prototypes and instead you put .NET class library system.
Oh, really? Okay.
And take out the dynamic nature of JavaScript and make it strongly typed. So you have to declare your variables. You have to say,
really?
This is an integer, this is a float. Because, you know, JavaScript takes a very big performance hit from this dynamic feature. So what they've done is they need performance for games. So instead it's like, well, this is going to be a float, this is going to be a vector, this is going to be a...
Right.
So you have to strongly type all of your stuff so Mono can generate the most optimal code. For you. So those are the three languages supported by Unity, and you can use those to build your apps. So you can still reuse your C# skills, but not your API skills.
Right.
You need
to
develop new API skills for, you know, for games.
Okay.
Cool. And you know, there's not like 60 or 80 games on the App Store, official games built with Mono.
That's awesome though.
The early ones were not as good. The new ones are pretty good. And one of them is like on the top 10 game category.
Do you know the names you can name drop?
Yeah, sure. You know, I'm a partisan person, so I actually buy the good ones. So let me tell you which ones I'll tell you which ones my favorites are. Zombieville, that's pretty good. That's one of the top 10. The biplane game is also pretty good. Shipstacker is cute. And the Joyride also got really good reviews, but it's not my kind of game.
Okay.
It's kind of, you drive this war vehicle around the field, and you have to kill the enemies and so on. So you know, we're pretty excited about that.
Cool.
Now, what we want to do, though, because I already told you, we don't want to do GTK#. We don't really want to do Cocoa# because it would be a one-time investment for the iPhone.
Yeah.
And there's really not much in it for us right now. You know, if the open source community wants to do it, fine, but Novell really doesn't see a lot of value in that.
Okay.
So what we want to do, though, is once we ship Silverlight 2, is build Silverlight 2 to app, to iPhone compiler. So take your zap file that you took for Silverlight.
Oh, I love
make
it.
Sure that it runs in the correct screen.
Right.
We'll provide a style that will make your apps and your buttons look like Silverlight buttons. I mean, like iPhone buttons.
Right.
So we'll style it. We'll provide a theme that looks like the iPhone.
This is literally just, I mean, you're not doing anything iPhone. It's just using the XAML template that does that.
Yeah, so use a XAML template that looks like an iPhone. So, you know, the iPhone has a couple of styles, like three different styles for button.
Right.
So we'll provide those. You'll skin the app the way you want it. Make sure an expression that it looks right at that resolution.
Right.
And then hit the button and you get a native app. And then just get it through Apple's QA, and that's it. So it's going to be a statically compiled Silverlight app.
That
it won't
awesome.
Be activated on the browser, so Don't expect it to run from the Safari.
Right. This is literally, I have to download the app from the App Store, click the button, and so how the hell are you doing it?
How are you doing? It's the static compilation system that I talked about.
Yeah, but I'm saying, like, in terms of the rendering engine for Silverlight, like, because it's now, are you reusing the offline apps? Because, like, mentally, I'm like, okay, if you had to do it, like, you would do, like, a browser engine, just because I'm thinking in sort of Silverlight 2 terms.
Yeah, yeah. There's no, with Silverlight, you really build your application, and you have hooks to talk to the browser, right? Obviously, if you use those ones, they won't run when we publish this thing, right? We haven't done it, just so you know. Our first goal is finish Silverlight 2. Once we have that, then we can do the iPhone port.
Okay.
So, obviously, if you try to talk to the browser, it won't be there. But as long as, you know, for example, the app that they showed today for doing audio playback, there's no reason why you could, for the KEXP. You know, that's an application that really, you know, it takes advantage of offline, but it was just, you know, it's a standalone app inside the browser, and that's what you're going to get. So if you build a gadget in Silverlight 2 or 3, you'll be able to take your Zap file and bring it to the iPhone.
That's awesome.
So, you know, that's, I'd rather invest time and effort into that particular, you know, adventure than trying to do Coco and trying to do, you know.
Yeah, I think
seems like a one-off effort.
Every Silverlight developer would appreciate being able to take their skills, and especially if you guys are doing, like, the heavy lifting stuff.
That's right. So,
and in terms of one thing, just to get back to the sort of the static compilation, have you actually tried to compare applications where you're statically compiling versus jitted applications and seeing if there's performance degradation or is there performance improvements? Because certainly this is a debate that, you know, you go back to the Jason Zander days where they were saying, you know, should we be having a CLR and the issues where you now have dependencies and if you have to, say, service a DLL, you're now servicing 20 different applications and why
you run into that problem. Yes, you will run into that problem. If you have a, you know, if you have a bug, and we fix the bug upstream, there's no, you know, there's no mono framework to share on the iPhone.
Right.
It's a static library, so you do run into those issues.
But what about just performance? Just thinking, because
so
a lot
let
of
me
people
think about that for a second.
A lot of people go back and forth and say, well, you guys should have done it this way and that way. I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
No, so it's a complex answer because the way we built it. When you cheat code, one of the advantages is, let's say that you're jitting a piece of code to do a specific calculation, and it needs to call some functions, and it needs to fetch some variables. So you know where in memory the code is going to live, right? So you know that you're going to jit it, and you're going to put it here, right? And if you need to make a call to a routine, you can make a direct call from here to the target address, and you can actually hard code the addresses of variables, for example, right? So that means that the code is optimized for that particular location in memory where it's going to live. When you do what we call it ahead of time compilation, right? We actually need to generate code that can be moved because you don't know at what address the code is going to be loaded by the operating system, right? So what happens is that you generate code that is a little bit more inefficient. So when you do a call, you actually need to determine where you are because the code could have been shifted in memory, right? So there's a trigger where you basically call the next instruction, you do a call to the next IP, then you pop the register. And you use that as the offset to determine where other functions live.
Oh, interesting.
Right? So then you do a relative call to, you know, 100 some bytes or something or other, right?
Right.
So this is the origin of where we came from. It's kind of like the engine technology.
Right.
We came from that world where the code needed to be relocatable in memory. So what that means is that the code generated is a little bit more inefficient. You need to add these special call instructions, POPs, and you need to add the global offset table to fetch variables. And you have to make all calls indirect through a process, a procedural linkage table. So the code is a little bit more inefficient. And I don't know which changes we made when we did full static compilation, whether we can assume hard-coded addresses or not. And I don't know the answer to that. So we might just be as slow, you know, we might have this performance impact or we might not. And I can't give you a straight answer right now.
Yeah,
I would have to think about that. But, you know.
Because I think a lot of people debate that exact thing, saying, you know, one way is, you know, if you just did native execution, then you wouldn't have that load time when people say aren't engineering code. And
yeah, so, I mean, I don't have a lot of experience with people using .NET on Windows. I only have it on Linux. And mono on Linux is blazingly fast. it's not Java, of course, in terms of slow startup. Yeah. So it's very hard for me to know how badly we're doing there. I don't know if people really complain about this on Windows very much or not.
Well, I think developers always like to argue, no matter what choice is made,
yeah.
and do the comparison that if we only had, yeah. then therefore.
I don't know. Is WPF slow on Windows? I mean, I don't really know because I don't use Windows.
I think it depends on the application, but yeah. a lot of times people do the slow startup time. Now, in .NET 3.5 SP1, they did mm-hmm. a number of performance increases yeah. or improvements, and it was like 50% increase or so
yeah.
in sort of cold start. And some of the other scenarios that they had.
Yeah, so it's difficult to tell. But you know, yesterday I enjoyed this tweet from a friend of mine that said, why is it that Java applications takes longer to start up in the browser than my machine takes to boot? You know? So, you know, chip shot to the Java community. But, you know, with Moonlight, we don't actually have that problem.
Yeah.
And, you know, this morning we're actually having that discussion, wondering, maybe we're not doing something fundamental that we must be doing because it's starting too fast. So maybe we're missing like a check, or we're missing like
you're doing it wrong if it works.
We're doing
really
it wrong,
well.
Yeah. so something like that.
Oh, that's hilarious.
So but, you know, there's advantages to jitting, and there's because jitting, for example, you can tune the code to the particular architecture at runtime.
Right. Right. So, right.
And also, if you ship bytecodes, then the same code runs on. In our case, it's actually a big deal because the same code runs on x86, x86-64, PowerPC, ARM processors. I raised PowerPC 64, S390, S390X, mixed
right.
compiler. And, you know, we're now using Mono for, I didn't really want to talk about that at the PDC because it kind of broke the flow.
Yeah.
But it's being used for supercomputing on MIPS-based machines from this company called Cycortex, I think. You know, so they're massively parallel computers, and they're all MIPS machines. Right, so the same code that you run, the same binary, you happen to just to load it on thousands of machines at once.
And is it scientific, military?
Yeah, it's scientific. Well, okay. I'm sure the military uses it, you know. But
yeah, no, I just wasn't sure if there was an application.
Yeah, the CEO of the company used to be my boss at Novell many years ago.
Oh, okay.
Chris Stone. So
yeah,
so it's
good
nice.
To have.
Yeah, I was like, hey, Chris, how's it going?
Yeah,
so it was good.
Now, one of the things that you guys have been doing is using, say, some of the ASP.NET starter kits in Mono, and you know, yeah. applications sort of just work. There was a lot of talk in the keynote for ASP.NET MVC.
Mm-hmm.
What's the story for MVC developers and Mono? Is that something you guys are looking at, or is that sort of?
Yeah, well, so I was, the license for MVC, I haven't looked at the license that MVC 1.0 was published.
Mm-hmm.
The previous versions of MVC were published under, you know, this Microsoft Researchy license
sure.
that has a platform limitation. And there's some argument whether you can use the binaries from Microsoft on Mono or not, and I don't know the exact answer since the announcement this morning. But, you know, MVC is actually a small library that is built on the core of ASP.NET. So
I think it's 1.4 megabytes was the RTM download or something.
Yeah, but the binary is incredibly small. The actual DLL is incredibly
small.
Well,
I think 1.4 meg is tiny.
Yeah, so I think it's actually smaller than that. I think it's like
okay.
It's like, you know, it's
maybe that's
tiny.
With the installer.
Yeah, it's probably with the installer and templates and God knows what else. So you know, we'll keep an eye on what the license is. That's the first piece. But if not, we'll implement the ASP.NET MVC. We're excited about that, and we'll get it running on Mono soon. We kind of didn't want to start work on MVC before it reached final stage because we did that in the past with WCF.
And
with the early previews,
yeah.
And then they keep deprecating stuff, and you know, we just spent 2 months implementing that, and now it's dead, and now they added other stuff. So this time we said no implementation until we have a final product. So we'll start working on MVC right away.
Cool.
Yeah.
So any other stuff Novell's working on that you think is cool, or what sort of the up and coming things? I know you talked about some of the Silverlight
vaporware-ish issues.
I love the iPhone Silverlight.
So there's a couple. I mean, things that we're working on is we're about to ship our Mono Develop 2 IDE,
mm-hmm.
and it actually comes with ASP.NET MVC templates.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. So we don't have the runtime, but we have the templates. And it's a big advancement from Mono Develop came from the Sharp Develop world, and it's an early fork that we did to Linuxify it. So this has a massive update to our autocomplete engine. It does full C# 3, mm-hmm. which we're very proud of.
Excellent.
You know, it has a very new template system. It has support for T4 that a guy implemented in over a week, and it's really pretty.
Yeah, so what are your thoughts on T4? Because
I didn't have thoughts 2 weeks ago. I didn't know it existed.
Oh, okay.
I went to al.net and people told me, oh, we're using it for this, for link templates, for MSVC templates, for these templates. They were using it for everything over there.
Yeah.
So we figured we need to tap into that. And I mentioned that casually over lunch to a friend of mine who works in MonoDevelop and initially who was a little bit grumpy. And I didn't want him to work on that because, you know, I don't want to distract him.
Yeah.
But he kind of fell in love with it and ran with it. And within 2 days, he had an implementation.
Wow.
2 days later, he had it integrated into MonoDevelop. And by Sunday, he had, he had autocomplete and he had the syntax highlighting working on the IDE. And, you know, by Monday, we were using it in our own projects with our own templates.
Wow.
So, you know, that was a nice discovery. You know, discovering T4 was a very interesting thing for us. So there's that. MonoDevelop is a big thing for us. Just bringing an IDE that brings kind of the productivity to people that people kind of expect from Visual Studio.
And one thing, you were talking about C# 3, and I'm sure you saw Anders talk at PDC on C#
yeah.
4. What are your sort of quick thoughts on there?
Yeah, so quickly, I like what has been proposed. I think there's too much of an emphasis on COM that we don't really care about.
Right.
It doesn't exist on Linux. But we're, again, with C# 4, we're kind of waiting a little bit for the standard to mature before we devote tremendous resources to that.
Okay.
So, one of the guys already, one of the open source contributors already said, I'm not waiting, I'm implementing. And see, he already implemented some pieces. So, I can't complain. It's Scott Peterson from New York.
Wow.
So he did that piece, and that was really good. And we also have some features of C# 5 already. You know, we have our own evaluator, the C# embeddable, the compiler as a service.
Okay, yeah.
And in fact, the Unity guys just embedded our compiler into Unity. So now you can prototype and type C# expressions within Unity. You can even do it in your web project. So when you have, your plugin running your game, you can actually debug it with C# live.
Oh, really?
On the game. Yes, you should.
Oh,
I just
awesome.
Blogged about that this morning, so you can see it. You can see that flash video.
I
that
will
stuff.
Have to check that out.
So, it's exciting, MonoDevelop, the debugger, C#, REPL loop. What else is in the pipeline? This is the first for us because we're not Windows guys, but we're working right now on a Visual Studio plugin, so you can, from Visual Studio, deploy to Linux machine, debug the Linux machine, and create packages for the Linux machine.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
so,
interesting.
So, we're really excited about that.
Yeah. In terms of, because I know you're kind of like a language geek, what do you think of sort of like the move even more towards the dynamic typing, where you see like keywords like dynamic and some of the things
I love
were
it.
Like embedded in?
I love that C# is not kind of a very, how do you call this? I like that Anders is open to expanding the language in the ways that make sense,
mm-hmm.
right? So, people requested
pragmatic
many features from C# for years, and Anders has always said, well, let's first understand how it works. And once we have a good understanding, let's put it in. Because once it's in, it doesn't come out.
Right.
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 So I really like the approach that Anders has taken with language design, obviously. And I think that dynamic, a lot of people wanted to see dynamic happen. People just didn't understand how it should actually work.
Right.
And I'm glad that C# 4 is going to get it. Because you really need this bridge with the dynamic languages. And just having a static language is just not gonna cut it in the long term. So having this bridge that lets you talk to JavaScript, be very native with Ruby or Iron
yeah.
Python and so on.
And DLR and Silverlight scenarios
yes.
too, where it sort of opens up a brave new world, if you will.
And it was you could call into these things in the past. It just was very cumbersome and very annoying. And then
right.
And you could see people saying why why should I bother with this in the first place?
It didn't feel natural as part
yes.
of the language, so.
So it's the best of both worlds. You get your strong typing when you need strong typing, and it's good practices for large projects, multiple developers, things that you have to maintain over the long period of time, IntelliSense and so on. But when you need to talk to other things or you need to get something done quickly, you can always fall back to dynamic. So I like this thing where C# is, it got generics, now it got a lot of functional features into the language,
yeah,
and now it's
yeah.
getting dynamic features. So it's a really nice blend of... I like that the language is being evolved and maintained and not just abandoned.
Yes,
right?
Yeah.
Like not, well, this is what C# is, and if you don't like it, use something else. So I like that it's actually a language that adapts to a changing landscape.
Yeah. Cool.
So that's it.
Cool. All right. Well, any other stuff or?
I can't think of anything.
We certainly talked about a lot. So.
Yeah. We'll have another interview in the future, I guess.
Yes, exactly. All right. Well, thanks, Miguel. Thanks for the time.
Thank you very much, Len.
Thanks.